This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents Mindware, Tools for Smart Thinking. Written by Richard E. Nisbet. Performed by Joe Barrett.
Visual aids found in the print edition of this book are available to you as a downloadable PDF. To access this file, please click the link on the product page where you purchased this title. Thank you.
Introduction. The logic of science is the logic of business and of life. John Stuart Mill. In an earlier era, when many people were involved in surveying land, it made sense to require that almost every student entering a top college know something of trigonometry. Today, a basic grounding in probability, statistics, and decision analysis makes far more sense. Lawrence Summers, former president of Harvard University. The word cosine never, ever comes up. Roz Chast, Secrets of Adulthood. You paid $12 for a ticket to a movie that you realize after a half an hour of watching it is quite uninteresting and tedious. Should you stay at the theater or leave? You own two stocks, one of which has done quite well over the past few years and the other of which has actually lost a little since you bought it. You need some money and have to sell one of the stocks. Do you sell the successful stock in order to avoid locking in your losses on the unsuccessful stock? Or do you sell the unsuccessful stock in hopes that the successful one will continue to make more money? You must choose between two candidates for a job. Candidate A has more experience and stronger recommendations than candidate B, but in the interview, candidate B seems brighter and more energetic than candidate A. Which do you hire? You are a human relations officer for a company. Several women have written you to complain that their job applications were turned down in favor of men with poorer job qualifications. How could you go about finding whether there is really discrimination on the basis of gender? Time magazine recently reported that parents should not try to control their children's food intake because parents who do that have children who are likely to be overweight. Do you see anything dubious about that claim? People who have a drink or two of alcohol once a day have fewer cardiovascular problems than people who don't. Assuming you drink less than that, should you increase your alcohol intake? Should you decrease it if you drink more than that? Problems like those don't appear on IQ tests, but there are smarter and less smart ways of solving them. By the time you've finished this book, you'll have a cognitive toolkit that will allow you to think about such problems and infinitely more besides, much differently than you would now. The tools are 100 or so concepts, principles, and rules of inference developed by scientists in many fields, especially psychology and economics, and by statisticians, logicians, and philosophers. Sometimes common sense approaches to problems produce errors in judgment and unfortunate actions. The concepts in this book will show you how to think and act more effectively. The ideas provide a supplement to common sense, rules and principles you can learn to apply automatically and effortlessly to countless problems that crop up in everyday life. This book addresses some of the most fundamental questions about how to reason and make valid inferences. What counts as an explanation for everything from why our friend acts in such an annoying way to why a product launch failed? How can we tell the difference between events that are causally related and events that are merely associated with each other in time or place? What kinds of knowledge can be considered certain and what kinds only conjectural? What are the characteristics of a good theory in science and in everyday life? How can we tell the difference between theories that can be falsified and those that can't? If we have a theory about what kinds of business or professional practices are effective, how can we test that theory in a convincing way? The media bombard us with alleged scientific findings, many of which are simply wrong. How can we evaluate conflicting scientific claims we encounter in the media? When should we trust the experts, assuming we can find them, and when should we be dubious? And most important, how can we increase the likelihood that the choices we make will best serve our purposes and improve the lives of ourselves and others? Can reasoning really be taught? But can people actually be taught to think more effectively? Not just to know more things, such as the capital of Uzbekistan or the procedure for extracting square roots, but actually to reason more correctly and solve personal and professional problems more satisfactorily? The answer to this question is far from obvious, though for 2,600 years, many philosophers and educators were confident that reasoning could be taught. Plato said, "Even the dull, if they have had arithmetical training, always become much quicker than they would otherwise have been. We must endeavor to persuade those who are to be the principal men of our state to go and learn arithmetic." Later, Roman philosophers added studying grammar and exercising the memory to the practices that would improve reasoning. The medieval scholastics emphasized logic, particularly syllogisms. For example, all men are mortal, Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is mortal. The humanists of the Renaissance added Latin and Greek, possibly because they thought that using those languages contributed to the success of these ancient civilizations. The faith in drilling mathematical, logical, and linguistics rules was strong enough that by the 19th century, some people believed that pure exercise of the brain on difficult rule systems, any difficult rule system, was enough to make people smarter. A 19th century educator was able to maintain, "My claim for Latin, as an Englishman and a teacher, is simply that it would be impossible to devise for English boys a better teaching instrument. The acquisition of a language is educationally of no importance. What is important is the process of acquiring it. The one great merit of Latin as a teaching instrument is its tremendous difficulty." There never was a shred of evidence for any of these educational views, from those of Plato to those of the fusty old Latin teacher. So psychologists in the early 20th century set out to produce some scientific evidence about reasoning and how to improve it. The early returns were not good for what had come to be called formal discipline, training in how to think as opposed to what to know. At the turn of the century, Edward Thorndike maintained that no amount of brain exercise or drilling in abstract rules of thought would serve to make people smarter, and pronounced the learning Latin theory of education to be defunct. He claimed that his experiments showed that transfer of training from one cognitive task to another occurred only if the problems were extremely similar in their concrete features. But the tasks that Thorndike studied didn't really qualify as ones involving reasoning. For example, he found that practicing cancellation of letters in a sentence produced no increase in speed of canceling parts of speech in a paragraph. This is scarcely what you would think of as reasoning. Herbert Simon and Alan Newell, the great mid-century computer scientists, also claimed that people couldn't learn abstract rules for reasoning and provided somewhat better evidence. But their argument was based on very limited observations. Learning how to solve the Towers of Hanoi problem, transferring a stack of disks from one pole to another without ever placing a bigger disk on a smaller one, a game you may have played as a child, didn't produce improvement on the missionaries and cannibals problem, which requires a plan for getting missionaries across a river without ever allowing the missionaries on the boat to be outnumbered by the cannibals. The two problems have the same formal structure, but there was no transfer of training how to solve one problem to ability to solve the other. This result was interesting, but scarcely enough to convince us that training on a given problem could never generalize to solving a problem with a similar structure. Jean Piaget, the great Swiss cognitive psychologist who studied children's learning, was an exception to the mid-20th century consensus against abstract rules for reasoning. He believed that people did indeed possess such rules, including logical rules and schemas for understanding concepts such as probability. But he believed such rules couldn't be taught. Rather, they could only be induced as the child encounters more and more problems that can be solved using a particular rule that she discovers for herself. Moreover, the set of abstract rules for understanding the world is complete by adolescence, and every cognitively normal person ends up with the exact same set of rules. Piaget got it right about the existence of abstract concepts and rule systems that people could apply in everyday life, but got everything else wrong. Such rule systems can be taught as well as induced. We keep on learning them well beyond adolescence, and people differ dramatically in the particular set of abstract rules for reasoning that they use. The early 20th century psychologists opposed to the concept of formal discipline were right about one very important matter. Getting smarter is not a matter of sheer exercise of the brain. The mind is like a muscle in some ways, but not in others. Lifting pretty much anything will make you stronger, but thinking about just anything in any old way is not likely to make you smarter. Learning Latin almost certainly produces little gain in reasoning ability. The nature of the concepts and rules you're trying to learn is everything when it comes to building the muscles of the mind. Some are useless for building brain muscles, and some are priceless. Ideas that travel. The idea for this book came from my fascination with the fact that scientists' ideas in one field can be extremely valuable for other fields. A favorite buzzword in academia is interdisciplinary. I'm pretty sure that some people who use the word might not be able to tell you why interdisciplinary research is a good idea. But it is, and here's why. Science is often described as a seamless web. What's meant by that is that the facts, methods, theories, and rules of inference discovered in one field can be helpful for other fields. And philosophy and logic can affect reasoning in literally every field of science. Field theory in physics gave rise to field theory in psychology. Particle physicists use statistics developed for psychologists. Scientists studying agricultural practice invented statistical tools that are crucial for behavioral scientists. Theories developed by psychologists to describe how rats learn to run mazes guided computer scientists in their effort to teach machines how to learn. Darwin's theory of natural selection owes a great deal to 18th century Scottish philosophers' theories about social systems. In particular, Adam Smith's theory that societal wealth is created by rational actors pursuing their own selfish interests. Economists are now making major contributions to the understanding of human intelligence and self-control. Economists' views about how people make choices were transformed by cognitive psychologists, and economists' scientific tools were greatly expanded by adopting the experimental techniques used by social psychologists. Modern sociologists owe a great deal to 18th and 19th century philosophers who theorized about the nature of society. Cognitive psychologists and social psychologists are broadening the range of questions raised by philosophers and have begun to propose answers to some long-standing philosophical conundrums. Philosophical questions about ethics and theory of knowledge guide the research of psychologists and economists. Neuroscience research and concepts are transforming psychology, economics, and even philosophy. A few examples from my own research will show how extensive the borrowing can be from one field of science to another. I was trained as a social psychologist, but most of my early research dealt with feeding behavior and obesity. When I began the work, the lay assumption, as well as the scientific and medical view, was that people who are overweight get that way by eating too much. But eventually, it became clear that most overweight people were actually hungry. Psychologists studying obesity borrowed from biology the homeostatic concept of a set point. The body attempts to maintain a set point for temperature, for example. The obese have a set point for the ratio of fat to other tissue that differs from that of normal weight people. But social norms drive them toward being thin, with the result that they're chronically hungry. The next problem I studied was how people understand the causes of the behavior of other people and themselves. Field theory in physics prompted research showing that situational and contextual factors are often more important in producing behavior than personal dispositions, such as traits, abilities, and preferences. This conceptualization made it easy to see that our causal explanations for behavior, our own, other people's, and even that of objects, tend to slight situational factors while overemphasizing dispositional factors. In studying causal attributions, it became clear to me that much of the time we have very limited insight into the causes of our own behavior, and we have no direct access at all to our thought processes. This work on self-awareness owes a great deal to Michael Polanyi, a chemist turned philosopher of science. He argued that much of our knowledge, even about matters we deal with in our field of expertise, perhaps especially about such matters, is tacit and difficult or impossible to articulate. Work by me and others on the vagaries of introspection called into question all research that depends on self-reports about mental processes and the causes of one's own behavior. Measurement techniques in psychology and throughout the behavioral and social sciences have changed as a result of this work. The research has also convinced some students of the law that self-reports about motives and goals can be highly unreliable, not for reasons of self-enhancement or self-protection, but because so much of mental life is inaccessible. The errors discovered in self-reports led me to a concern with the accuracy of our inferences in everyday life in general. Following the cognitive psychologists Amos Tversky and Daniel Kahneman, I compared people's reasoning to scientific, statistical, and logical standards and found large classes of judgments to be systematically mistaken. Inferences frequently violate principles of statistics, economics, logic, and basic scientific methodology. Work by psychologists on these questions has influenced philosophers, economists, and policymakers. Finally, I've done research showing that East Asians and Westerners sometimes make inferences about the world in fundamentally different ways. This research was guided by the ideas of philosophers, historians, and anthropologists. I became convinced that Eastern habits of thought, which have been called dialectical, provide powerful tools for thinking that can benefit Westerners as much as they have helped Easterners for thousands of years. Scientific and philosophical thinking can be taught in ways that affect reasoning in everyday life. My research on reasoning has had big effects on my reasoning in everyday life. I am constantly discovering that many of the concepts that travel across scientific fields are also affecting my approach to professional and personal problems. At the same time, I am constantly being made aware of my failures to use the kinds of reasoning tools I study and teach. Naturally, I began to wonder whether other people's thinking about everyday life events are affected by training and concepts learned in school. Initially, I was quite dubious that a course or two dealing with one or another approach to reasoning could have the kind of impact on people that long exposure to the concepts had on me. The 20th century skepticism about the possibility of teaching reasoning continued to influence my thinking. I could not have been more mistaken. It turns out that the courses people take in college really do affect inferences about the world, often very markedly. Rules of logic, statistical principles such as the law of large numbers and regression to the mean, principles of scientific methodology, such as how to establish control groups when making assertions about cause and effect, classical economic principles, and decision theory concepts all influence the way people think about problems that crop up in everyday life. They affect how people reason about athletic events, what procedures they think are best for going about the process of hiring someone, and even their approach to such minor questions as whether they should finish a meal that isn't very tasty. Since some university courses greatly improve people's reasoning about everyday life events, I decided to see whether I could teach such concepts in the laboratory. My coworkers and I developed techniques for teaching inferential rules that are helpful for reasoning about common personal and professional problems. As it turned out, people readily learned from these brief sessions. Teaching about the statistical concept of the law of large numbers affected their reasoning about how much evidence is needed to reach accurate beliefs about some object or person. Teaching about the economic principle of avoiding opportunity costs affected how they reasoned about time usage. Most impressively, we sometimes questioned subjects weeks later in contexts where they didn't know they were being studied, such as telephone polls allegedly being conducted by survey researchers. We were delighted to find that people often retained substantial ability to apply the concepts to ordinary problems outside the laboratory context in which the concepts had been taught. Most important, we discovered how to greatly extend the reach of inferential rules to problems of everyday life. We can have complete command over good principles for reasoning in a particular field, and yet be unable to apply them to the full panoply of problems that we encounter in everyday life. But these inferential principles can be made more accessible and usable. The key is learning how to frame events in such a way that the relevance of the principles to the solutions of particular problems is made clear, and learning how to code events in such a way that the principles can actually be applied to the events. We don't normally think of forming impressions of an individual's personality as a statistical process consisting of sampling a population of events, but they are exactly that. And framing them in that way makes us both more cautious about some kinds of personality ascriptions and better able to predict the individual's behavior in the future. There were several criteria that guided me in selecting particular concepts to write about. 1. The concept had to be important, for science and for life. There are scores of syllogisms that have been around since the Middle Ages, but only a few have even the remotest relevance to everyday life, and it's those that are in the book. There are hundreds of types of fallacious reasoning that have been identified, but only a relative few are mistakes that intelligent people actually make with any frequency. It's those few that I deal with. 2. The concept had to be teachable, in my opinion at least. I know for a fact that many of the concepts are teachable in such a way that they can be used in scientific and professional pursuits and in everyday life. This is true of many concepts that university courses teach, and I have successfully taught many of those, as well as many others, in brief laboratory sessions. The remainder of the concepts are similar enough to the ones I know to be teachable that I include them in the book. 3. Most of the concepts form the core of systems of thought. For example, all of the concepts taught in the crucial first semester statistics course are presented in this book. These concepts are essential for reasoning about a huge variety of problems, ranging from what retirement plan to choose to whether you have enough evidence to decide whether a given job candidate would make a good employee. Taking a course in statistics is not going to help you much in solving those problems, though. Statistics is usually taught in such a way that people can see only that it applies to data of particular, rather limited types. What's needed is what's provided in this book, namely the ability to code events and objects in such a way that rough-and-ready versions of statistical principles can be applied to them. The book also presents the most important concepts of microeconomics and decision theory, the basic principles of the scientific method as they apply to solving everyday problems, the basic concepts of formal logic, the much less familiar principles of dialectical reasoning, and some of the most important concepts developed by philosophers who study how scientists as well as ordinary folks think, or should think. 4. The concepts in the book can be triangulated to understand a given problem from many perspectives. For example, a particularly serious error in everyday life is gross overgeneralization from a small number of observations of a person, object, or event. This error is based on at least 4 mistakes that compound one another, one psychological, one statistical, one epistemological, epistemology concerns theory of knowledge, and one metaphysical. Metaphysics concerns beliefs about the fundamental nature of the world. Once each of these kinds of concepts is well understood, they can all be brought to bear on a given problem, supplementing and enhancing one another. Every concept in this book is relevant to the way you live your life and conduct your business. We fail to make a friend because we made hasty judgments based on insufficient evidence. We hire people who are not the most capable because we trusted firsthand information too much and more extensive and superior information from other sources too little. We lose money because we don't realize the applicability of statistical concepts such as standard deviation and regression and the relevance of psychological concepts such as the endowment effect, which causes us to want to keep things for no better reason than that we have them, and economic concepts such as sunk costs, which cause us to send good money after bad. We eat foods and take medicines and consume vitamins and other supplements that aren't good for us because we're not sufficiently skilled in evaluating alleged scientific findings about health practices. Society tolerates government and business practices that make our lives worse because they were developed without following effective evaluation procedures and remain untested long after they were introduced, sometimes for decades, and it costs in the billions of dollars. a sampling of the things to come. The first section of the book deals with thinking about the world and ourselves, how we do it, how we flub it, how to fix it, and how we can make far better use than we do of the dark matter of the mind, namely the unconscious. The second section is about choices, how classical economists think choices are made and how they think they ought to be made, and why modern behavioral economics provides both descriptions of actual choice behavior and prescriptions for it that are better and more useful in some ways than those of classical economics. The section provides suggestions for how to structure your life in order to avoid a wide range of choice pitfalls. The third section is about how to make categorizations of the world more accurately, how to detect relationships among events, and just as important, how to avoid seeing relationships when they aren't there. Here we'll examine how to detect errors in reasoning we encounter in the media, at the office, and in bull sessions. The fourth section is about causality, how to distinguish between cases where one event causes another and cases where events occur close together in time or place, but aren't causally related. How to identify the circumstances in which experiments, and only experiments, can make us confident that events are related causally, and how we can learn to be happier and more effective by conducting experiments on ourselves. The fifth section is about two very different types of reasoning. One of these, logic, is abstract and formal, and has always been central to Western thought. The other, dialectical reasoning, consists of principles for deciding about the truth and practical utility of propositions about the world. This approach to reasoning has always been central to Eastern thought. Versions of the approach have been around in Western thought since the time of Socrates. But only recently have thinkers tried to describe dialectical thought in a systematic way or relate it to the tradition of formal logic. The sixth section is about what constitutes a good theory about some aspect of the world. How can we be sure that what we believe is actually true? Why is it that simpler explanations are normally more useful than more complicated ones? How can we avoid coming up with slipshod and overly facile theories? How can theories be verified? And why should we be skeptical of any assertion that can't, at least in principle, be falsified? The sections of the book support one another. Understanding what we can and can't observe about our mental life tells us when to rely on intuition when solving a problem and when to turn to explicit rules about categorization, choice, or assessment of causal explanations. Learning about how to maximize the outcomes of choices depends on what's been learned about the unconscious and how to make it an equal partner with the conscious mind when choosing actions or predicting what will make us happy. Learning about statistical principles tips us off about when we need to reach for our rules for assessing causality. Knowledge of how to assess causality encourages us to trust experiments far more than simple observation of events and shows how important and how easy it can be to conduct experiments to tell us what business practices and personal behaviors are most likely to benefit us. Learning about logic and dialectical reasoning provides suggestions for different ways to come up with theories about a given aspect of the world, which in turn can suggest what kinds of methods will be necessary to test those theories. You won't have a higher IQ when you finish this book, but you'll be smarter. Part 1. Thinking about thought. Psychological research has produced three major insights about the way the mind works that will change the way you think about how you think. The first is the proposition that our understanding of the world is always a matter of construal, of inference and interpretation. Our judgments about people and situations, and even our perceptions of the physical world, rely on stored knowledge and hidden mental processes and are never a direct readout of reality. A full appreciation of the degree to which our understanding of the world is based on inferences makes it clear how important it is to improve the tools we use to make those inferences. Second, the situations we find ourselves in affect our thoughts and determine our behavior far more than we realize. People's dispositions, on the other hand, their distinctive traits, attitudes, abilities, and tastes, are much less influential than we assume. So we make mistakes in assessing why it is that people, including ourselves, believe particular things and behave in particular ways. But it's possible to overcome this fundamental attribution error to a degree. Finally, psychologists have increasingly come to recognize the importance of the unconscious mind, which registers vastly more environmental information than the conscious mind could possibly notice. Many of the most important influences on our perceptions and behavior are hidden from us, and we are never directly aware of the mental processes that produce our perceptions, beliefs, and behavior. Fortunately, and perhaps surprisingly, the unconscious is fully as rational as the conscious mind. It solves many kinds of problems the conscious mind can't deal with effectively. A few simple strategies allow us to harness the unconscious mind's problem-solving capacities. Chapter 1. Everything's an inference. Without a profound simplification, the world around us would be an infinite, undefined tangle that would defy our ability to orient ourselves and decide upon our actions. We are compelled to reduce the knowable to a schema. Primo Levi, the drowned and the saved. First baseball umpire, I call him as I see him. Second umpire, I call them as they are. Third umpire, they ain't nothing till I call them. When we look at a bird, or a chair, or a sunset, it feels as if we're simply registering what is in the world. But in fact, our perceptions of the physical world rely heavily on tacit knowledge and mental processes we're unaware of that help us perceive something or accurately categorize it. We know that perception depends on mental doctoring of the evidence, because it's possible to create situations in which the inference processes we apply automatically lead us astray. In an illusion created by the psychologist Roger Shepard involving a drawing of two tables, it's pretty obvious that one of the tables is longer and thinner than the other. Obvious, but wrong. The two tables are of equal length and width. The illusion is based on the fact that our perceptual machinery decides for us that we're looking at the end of the table on the left and the side of the table on the right. Our brains are wired so that they lengthen lines that appear to be pointing away from us. And a good thing, too. We evolved in a three-dimensional world, and if we didn't tamper with a sense impression, what falls on the eye's retina, we would perceive objects that are far away as being smaller than they are. But what the unconscious mind brings to perception misleads us in the two-dimensional world of pictures. As a result of the brain's automatically increasing the size of things that are far away, the table on the left appears longer than it is, and the table on the right appears wider than it is. When the objects aren't really receding into the distance, the correction produces an incorrect perception. Schemas. We aren't too distressed when we discover that lots of unconscious processes allow us to correctly interpret the physical world. We live in a three-dimensional world, and we don't have to worry about the fact that the mind makes mistakes when it's forced to deal with an unnatural, two-dimensional world. It's more unsettling to learn that our understanding of the non-material world, including our beliefs about the characteristics of other people, is also utterly dependent on stored knowledge and hidden reasoning processes. Meet Donald, a fictitious person experimenters have presented to participants in many different studies. Donald spent a great amount of his time in search of what he'd like to call excitement. He had already climbed Mount McKinley, shot the Colorado Rapids in a kayak, driven in a demolition derby, and piloted a jet-powered boat, without knowing very much about boats. He had risked injury and even death a number of times. Now he was in search of new excitement. He was thinking perhaps he would do some skydiving or maybe cross the Atlantic in a sailboat. By the way he acted, one could readily guess that Donald was well aware of his ability to do many things well. Other than business engagements, Donald's contacts with people were rather limited. He felt he didn't really need to rely on anyone. Once Donald made up his mind to do something, it was as good as done, no matter how long it might take or how difficult the going might be. Only rarely did he change his mind, even when it might well have been better if he had. Before reading the paragraph about Donald, participants first took part in a bogus perception experiment in which they were shown a number of trait words. Half the participants saw the words self-confident, independent, adventurous, and persistent embedded among 10 trait words. The other half saw the words reckless, conceited, aloof, and stubborn. Then the participants moved on to the next study, in which they read the paragraph about Donald and rated him on a number of traits. The Donald paragraph was intentionally written to be ambiguous as to whether Donald is an attractive, adventurous sort of person or an unappealing, reckless person. The perception experiment reduced the ambiguity and shaped readers' judgments of Donald. Seeing the words self-confident, persistent, and so on resulted in a generally favorable opinion of Donald. Those words conjure up a schema of an active, exciting, interesting person. Seeing the words reckless, stubborn, and so on triggers a schema of an unpleasant person concerned only with his own pleasures and stimulation. Since the 1920s, psychologists have made much use of the schema concept. The term refers to cognitive frameworks, templates, or rule systems that we apply to the world to make sense of it. The progenitor of the modern concept of schema is the Swiss developmental psychologist Jean Piaget. For example, Piaget described the child's schema for the conservation of matter, the rule that the amount of matter is the same, regardless of the size and shape of the container that holds it. If you pour water from a tall, narrow container into a short, wide one, and ask a young child whether the amount of water is more, less, or the same, the child is likely to say either more or less. An older child will recognize that the amount of water is the same. Piaget also identified more abstract rule systems, such as the child's schema for probability. We have schemas for virtually every kind of thing we encounter. There are schemas for house, family, civil war, insect, fast food restaurant, lots of plastic, bright primary colors, many children, so-so food, and fancy restaurant, quiet, elegant decor, expensive, high likelihood the food will be quite good. We depend on schemas for construal of the objects we encounter and the nature of the situation we're in. Schemas affect our behavior as well as our judgments. The social psychologist John Barge and his co-workers had college students make grammatical sentences out of a scramble of words. For example, read, Fred, light, ran. For some participants, a number of the words, Florida, old, gray, wise, were intended to call up the stereotype of an elderly person. Other participants made sentences from words that didn't play into the stereotype of the elderly. After completing the unscrambling task, the experimenters dismissed the participants. The experimenters measured how rapidly the participants walked away from the lab. Participants who had been exposed to the word suggestive of elderly people walked more slowly toward the elevator than unprimed participants. If you're going to interact with an old person, the schema for which one version of the sentence unscrambling task calls up, it's best not to run around and act too animated. That is, if you have positive attitudes toward the elderly. Students who are not favorably disposed toward the elderly actually walk faster after the elderly prime. Without our schemas, life would be, in William James's famous words, a blooming, buzzing confusion. If we lacked schemas for weddings, funerals, or visits to the doctor, with their tacit rules for how to behave in each of these situations, we would constantly be making a mess of things. This generalization also applies to our stereotypes, or schemas about particular types of people. Stereotypes include introvert, party animal, police officer, Ivy Leaguer, physician, cowboy, priest. Such stereotypes come with rules about the customary way that we behave, or should behave, toward people who are characterized by the stereotypes. In common parlance, the word stereotype is a derogatory term. But we would get into trouble if we treated physicians the same as police officers or introverts the same as Good Time Charlies. There are, however, two problems with stereotypes. They can be mistaken in some or all respects, and they can exert undue influence on our judgments about people. Psychologists at Princeton had students watch a videotape of a fourth grader they called Hannah. One version of the video reported that Hannah's parents were professional people. It showed her playing in an obviously upper-middle-class environment. Another version reported that Hannah's parents were working class, and showed her playing in a rundown environment. The next part of the video showed Hannah answering 25 academic achievement questions dealing with math, science, and reading. Hannah's performance was ambiguous. She answered some difficult questions well, but sometimes seemed distracted or flubbed easy questions. The researchers asked the students how well they thought Hannah would perform in relation to her classmates. The students who saw an upper-middle-class Hannah estimated that she would perform better than average. While those who saw the working-class Hannah assumed she would perform worse than average. It's sad but true that you're actually more likely to make a correct prediction about Hannah if you know her social class than if you don't. In general, it's the case that upper-middle-class children perform better in school than working-class children. Whenever the direct evidence about a person or object is ambiguous, background knowledge in form of a schema or stereotype can increase accuracy of judgments to the extent that the stereotype has some genuine basis in reality. The much sadder fact is that working-class Hannah starts life with two strikes against her. People will expect and demand less of her, and they will perceive her performance as being worse than if she were upper-middle class. A serious problem with our reliance on schemas and stereotypes is that they can get triggered by incidental facts that are irrelevant or misleading. Any stimulus we encounter will trigger spreading activation to related mental concepts. The stimulus radiates from the initially activated concept to the concepts that are linked to it in memory. If you hear the word dog, the concept of bark, the schema for collie, and an image of your neighbor's dog Rex are simultaneously activated. We know about spreading activation effects because cognitive psychologists find that encountering a given word or concept makes us quicker to recognize related words and concepts. For example, if you say the word nurse to people a minute or so before you ask them to say true or false to statements such as hospitals are for sick people, they will say true more rapidly than if they hadn't just heard the word nurse. As we'll see, incidental stimuli influence not only the speed with which we recognize the truth of an assertion, but also our actual beliefs and behavior. But first, about those umpires who started off this chapter. Most of the time, we're like the second umpire, thinking that we're seeing the world the way it really is, and calling them as they are. That umpire is what philosophers and social psychologists call a naive realist. He believes that the senses provide us with a direct, unmediated understanding of the world. But in fact, our construal of the nature and meaning of events is massively dependent on stored schemas in the inferential processes they initiate and guide. We do partially recognize this fact in everyday life and realize that, like the first umpire, we really just call them as we see them. At least we see that's true for other people. We tend to think, I'm seeing the world as it is, and your different view is due to poor eyesight, muddled thinking, or self-interested motives. The third umpire thinks, they ain't nothing till I call them. All reality is merely an arbitrary construal of the world. This view has a long history. Right now, its advocates tend to call themselves postmodernists or deconstructionists. Many people answering to these labels endorse the idea that the world is a text, and no reading of it can be held to be any more accurate than any other. This view will be discussed in Chapter 16. The way to a judge's heart is through his stomach. Spreading activation makes us susceptible to all kinds of unwanted influences on our judgments and behavior. Incidental stimuli that drift into the cognitive stream can affect what we think and what we do, including even stimuli that are completely unrelated to the cognitive task at hand. Words, sights, sounds, feelings, and even smells can influence our understanding of objects and direct our behavior toward them. That can be a good thing or a bad thing, depending. Which hurricane is likely to kill more people, one named Hazel or one named Horace? Certainly seems it could make no difference. What's in a name, especially one selected at random by a computer? In fact, however, Hazel is likely to kill lots more people. Female-named hurricanes don't seem as dangerous as male-named ones, so people take fewer precautions. Want to make your employees more creative? Expose them to the Apple logo, and avoid exposing them to the IBM logo. It's also helpful for creativity to put your employees in a green or blue environment and avoid red at all costs. Want to get lots of hits on a dating website? In your profile photo, wear a red shirt, or at least put a red border around the picture. Want to get taxpayers to support education bond issues? Lobby to make schools the primary voting location. Want to get the voters to outlaw late-term abortion? Try to make churches the main voting venue. Want to get people to put a donation for coffee in the honest box? On a shelf above the coffee urn, place a coconut, arranged so that two of the eyes of the coconut appear above the third eye. That would be likely to cause people to behave more honestly. An inverted coconut would likely net you nothing. The first coconut is reminiscent of a human face. Coco is Spanish for head, and people subconsciously sense their behavior is being monitored. Tacitly, of course, people who literally think they're looking at a human face would be in dire need of an optometrist or a psychiatrist, possibly both. Actually, it's sufficient to just have a picture of three dots in the orientation of the first coconut to get more contributions. Want to persuade someone to believe something by giving them an editorial to read? Make sure the font type is clear and attractive. Messy-looking messages are much less persuasive. But if the person reads the editorial in a seafood store or on a wharf, its argument may be rejected. If the person is from a culture that uses the expression fishy to mean dubious, that is. If not, the fishy smell won't sway the person one way or the other. Starting up a company to increase IQ in kids? Don't call it something boring like Minnesota Learning Corporation. Try something like fatbrain.com instead. Companies with sexy, interesting names are more attractive to consumers and investors. But don't actually use fatbrain.com. That's the name of a company that really took off after it changed its drab name to that one. Bodily states also find their way into the cognitive stream. Want to be paroled from prison? Try to get a hearing right after lunch. Investigators found that if Israeli judges had just finished a meal, there was a 66% chance they would vote for parole. A case that came up just before lunch had precisely zero chance for parole. Want someone you're just about to meet to find you to be warm and cuddly? Hand them a cup of coffee to hold. And don't by any means make that an iced coffee. You may recall the scene in the movie Speed, where immediately after a harrowing escape from death on a careening bus, two previously unacquainted people, played by Keanu Reeves and Sandra Bullock, kiss each other passionately. It could happen. A man who answers a questionnaire administered by a woman while the two are standing on a swaying suspension bridge high above a river is much more eager to date her than if the interview takes place on terra firma. The study that found this effect is one of literally dozens that show that people can misattribute physiological arousal produced by one event to another altogether different one. If you're beginning to suspect that psychologists have a million of these, you wouldn't be far wrong. The most obvious implication of all the evidence about the importance of incidental stimuli is that you want to rig environments so that they include stimuli that will make you or your product or your policy goals attractive. It's obvious when stated that way. Less obvious are two facts. One, the effect of incidental stimuli can be huge. And two, you want to know as much as you possibly can about what kinds of stimuli produce what kinds of effects. A book by Adam Alter called Drunk Tank Pink is a good compendium of many of the effects we know about to date. Alter chose the title because of the belief of many prison officials and some researchers that pink walls make inebriated men tossed into a crowded holding cell less prone to violence. A less obvious implication of our susceptibility to incidental stimuli is the importance of encountering objects, and especially people, in a number of different settings if a judgment about them is to be of any consequence. That way, incidental stimuli associated with given encounters will tend to cancel one another out, resulting in a more accurate impression. Abraham Lincoln once said, "I don't like that man. I must get to know him better." To Lincoln's adage, I'd add, vary the circumstances of the encounters as much as possible. Framing. Consider the Trappist monks in two apocryphal stories. Monk 1 asked his abbot whether it would be all right to smoke while he prayed. Scandalized, the abbot said, of course not, that borders on sacrilege. Monk II asked his abbot whether it would be all right to pray while he smoked. Of course, said the abbot, God wants to hear from us at any time. Our construal of objects and events is influenced not just by the schemas that are activated in particular contexts, but by the framing of judgments we have to make. The order in which we encounter information of various kinds is one kind of framing. Monk II was well aware of the importance of order of input for framing his request. Framing can also be a matter of choosing between warring labels. And those labels matter not just for how we think about things and how we behave toward them, but also for the performance of products in the marketplace and the outcome of public policy debates. Your undocumented worker is my illegal alien. Your freedom fighter is my terrorist. Your inheritance tax is my death tax. You are in favor of abortion because you regard it as a matter of exercising choice. I am opposed because I am pro-life. My processed meat, which is 75% lean, is more attractive than your product, which has 25% fat content. And would you prefer a condom with a 90% success rate or one with a 10% failure rate? Makes no difference if I pit them against each other as I just did. But students told about the usually successful condom think it's better than do other students told about the sometimes unsuccessful condom. Framing can affect decisions that are literally a matter of life or death. The psychologist Amos Tversky and his colleagues told physicians about the effects of surgery versus radiation for a particular type of cancer. They told some physicians that of 100 patients who had the surgery, 90 lived through the immediate postoperative period, 68 were still alive at the end of a year, and 34 were still alive after 5 years. 82% of physicians given this information recommended surgery. Another group of physicians were given the same information, but in a different form. The investigators told them that 10 of 100 patients died during surgery or immediately thereafter, 32 had died by the end of the year, and 66 had died by the end of 5 years. Only 56% of physicians given this version of the survival information recommended surgery. Framing can matter. A lot. A cure for jaundice. We often arrive at judgments or solve problems by use of heuristics, rules of thumb that suggest a solution to a problem. Dozens of heuristics have been identified by psychologists. The effort heuristic encourages us to assume that projects that took a long time or cost a lot of money are more valuable than projects that didn't require so much effort or time. And in fact, that heuristic is going to be helpful more often than not. A price heuristic encourages us, mostly correctly, to assume that more expensive things are superior to things of the same general kind that are less expensive. A scarcity heuristic prompts us to assume that rarer things are more expensive than less rare things of the same kind. A familiarity heuristic causes Americans to estimate that Marseille has a bigger population than Nice, and Nice has a bigger population than Toulouse. Such heuristics are helpful guides for judgment. They'll often give us the right answer, and normally beat a stab in the dark, often by a long shot. Marseille does indeed have a bigger population than Nice, but Toulouse has a bigger population than Nice. Several important heuristics were identified by the Israeli cognitive psychologists Amos Tversky and Daniel Kahneman. The most important of their heuristics is the representativeness heuristic. This rule of thumb leans heavily on judgments of similarity. Events are judged as more likely if they're similar to the prototype of the event than if they're less similar. The heuristic is undoubtedly helpful more often than not. Homicide is a more representative cause of death than is asthma or suicide, so homicides seem more likely causes than asthma or suicide. Homicide is indeed a more likely cause of death than asthma, but there are twice as many suicide deaths in the United States in a given year than homicide deaths. Is she a Republican? In the absence of other knowledge, using the representativeness heuristic is about the best we can do. She is more similar to, representative of, my stereotype of Republicans than my stereotype of Democrats. A problem with that kind of use of the representativeness heuristic is that we often have information that should cause us to assign less weight to the similarity judgment. If we meet the woman at a Chamber of Commerce lunch, we should take that into account and shift our guess in the Republican direction. If we meet her at a breakfast organized by Unitarians, we should shift our guess in the Democrat direction. A particularly unnerving example of how the representativeness heuristic can produce errors concerns one Linda. Linda is 31 years old, single, outspoken, and very bright. She majored in philosophy. As a student, she was deeply concerned with issues of discrimination and social justice, and also participated in anti-nuclear demonstrations. After reading this little description, people were asked to rank 8 possible futures for Linda. 2 of these were bank teller and active in the feminist movement. Most people said that Linda was more likely to be a bank teller active in the feminist movement than just a bank teller. Feminist bank teller is more similar to the description of Linda than bank teller is. But of course, this is a logical error. The conjunction of 2 events can't be more likely than just 1 event by itself. Bank tellers include feminists, Republicans, and vegetarians. But the description of Linda is more nearly representative of a feminist bank teller than of a bank teller, so the conjunction error gets made. In a moment, I'll recite 4 sets of numbers. 2 were produced by a random number generator, and 2 were generated by me. Pick out the 2 sets that seem to you to be the most likely to have been produced by a random number generator. I'll tell you in just a bit which 2 they are. 1100011111111100100001001. 1100010010100100000. 101101101010100011100. 0011001101010001. Representative judgments can influence all kinds of estimates about probability. Kahneman and Tversky gave the following problem to undergraduates who hadn't taken any statistics courses. A certain town is served by 2 hospitals. In the larger hospital, about 45 babies are born each day, and in the smaller hospital, about 15 babies are born each day. As you know, about 50% of all babies are boys. The exact percentage of baby boys, however, varies from day to day. Sometimes it may be higher than 50%, sometimes lower. For a period of 1 year, each hospital recorded the days on which more than 60% of the babies born were boys. Which hospital do you think recorded more such days? Most of the students thought that the percent of babies that were boys would be the same in the 2 hospitals. As many thought it would be the larger hospital that would have the higher percentage as thought it would be the smaller hospital. In fact, it's vastly more likely that percentages of 60-plus for boys would occur in the small hospital. 60% is equally representative, or rather non-representative, of the population value, whether the hospital is small or large. But deviant values are far more likely when there are few cases than when there are many. If you doubt this conclusion, try this. There are 2 hospitals, one with 5 births per day and one with 50. Which hospital do you think would be expected to have 60% or more boy babies on a given day? Still recalcitrant? How about 5 babies versus 5,000? The representativeness heuristic can affect judgments of the probability of a limitless number of events. My grandfather was once a well-to-do farmer in Oklahoma. 1 year his crops were ruined by hail. He had no insurance, but he didn't bother to get any for the coming year because it was so unlikely the same thing would happen 2 years in a row. That's an unrepresentative pattern for hail. Hail is a rare event, and so any particular sequence of hail is unlikely. Unfortunately, hail doesn't remember whether it happened last year in northwest Tulsa or in southeast Norman. My grandfather did get hailed out the next year. He didn't bother to get insurance for the next year because it was really inconceivable that hail would strike the same place 3 years in a row. But that, in fact, did happen. My grandfather was bankrupted by his reliance on the representative heuristic to judge probabilities. As a consequence, I'm a psychologist rather than a wheat baron. Back to those sets of numbers I asked you about earlier. It's the first two that are genuinely random. They were two of the first three sequences I pulled from a random number generator. Honest, I did not cherry-pick beyond throwing out the one sequence. The last two sets I made up because they're more representative of a random sequence than random sequences are. The problem is that our conception of the randomness prototype is off-kilter. Random sequences have too many more long runs, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, and too many more regularities, 0, 1, 0, 1, 0, 1, 0, 1, than they should. Bear this in mind when you see a basketball player score points 5 times in a row. There's no reason to keep passing the ball to him any more than to some other player. The player with the hot hand is no more likely to make the shot than another player with a comparable record for the season. The more familiar you are with basketball, the less likely you are to believe this. The more familiar you are with statistics and probability theory, the more likely you are to believe it. The basketball error is characteristic of a huge range of mistaken inferences. Simply put, we see patterns in the world where there are none because we don't understand just how unrandom-looking random sequences can be. We suspect the dice roller of cheating because he gets 3 sevens in a row. In fact, 3 sevens are precisely as likely as 3-7-4 or 2-8-6. We hail a friend as a stock guru because all 4 of the stocks he bought last year did better than the market as a whole. But 4 hits is no less likely to happen by chance than 2 hits and 2 misses or 3 hits and 1 miss. So it's premature to hand over your portfolio to your friend. The representativeness heuristic sometimes influences judgments about causality. I don't know whether Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone in the assassination of John F. Kennedy or whether there was a conspiracy involving other people. I have no doubt, though, that part of the reason so many people have been convinced that there was a conspiracy is that they find it implausible that an event of such magnitude could have been affected by a single, quite unprepossessing individual acting alone. Some of the most important judgments about causality that we make concern the similarity of a disease and treatment for the disease. The Azandi people of Central Africa formerly believed that burnt skull of the red bush monkey was an effective treatment for epilepsy. The jerky, frenetic movements of the bush monkey resemble the convulsive movements of epileptics. The Azandi belief about proper treatment for epilepsy would have seemed sensible to Western physicians until rather recently. 18th century doctors believed in a concept called the doctrine of signatures. This was the belief that diseases could be cured by finding a natural substance that resembles the disease in some respect. Turmeric, which is yellow, would be effective in treating jaundice, in which the skin turns yellow. The lungs of the fox, which is known for strong powers of respiration, were considered a remedy for asthma. The belief in the doctrine of signatures was derived from a theological principle. God wishes to help us find the cures for diseases and gives us helpful hints in the form of color, shape, and movement. He knows we expect the treatment to be representative of the illness. This now sounds dubious to most of us, but in fact the representativeness heuristic continues to underlie alternative medicine practices such as homeopathy and Chinese traditional medicine, both of which are increasing in popularity in the West. Representativeness is often the basis for predictions when other information would actually be more helpful. About 20 years out from graduate school, a friend and I were talking about how successful our peers had been as scientists. We were surprised to find how wrong we were about many of them. Students we thought were sure to do great things often turned out to have done little in the way of good science. Students we thought were no great shakes turned out to have done lots of excellent work. In trying to figure out why we could have been so wrong, we began to realize that we relied on the representativeness heuristic. Our predictions were based in good part on how closely our classmates matched our stereotype of an excellent psychologist. Brilliant, well-read, insightful about people, fluent. Next, we tried to see whether there was any way we could have made better predictions. It quickly became obvious. The students who had done good work in graduate school did good work in their later career. Those who hadn't fizzled. The lesson here is one of the most powerful in all psychology. The best predictor of future behavior is past behavior. You're rarely going to do better than that. Honesty in the future is best predicted by honesty in the past, not by whether a person looks you steadily in the eye or claims a recent religious conversion. Competence as an editor is best predicted by prior performance as an editor, or at least by competence as a writer, and not by how verbally clever a person seems or how large the person's vocabulary is. Another important heuristic Tversky and Kahneman identified is the availability heuristic. This is a rule of thumb we use to judge the frequency or plausibility of a given type of event. The more easily examples of the event come to mind, the more frequent or plausible they seem. It's a perfectly helpful rule most of the time. It's easier to come up with the names of great Russian novelists than great Swedish novelists, and there are indeed more of the former than the latter. But are there more tornadoes in Kansas or in Nebraska? Pretty tempting to say Kansas, isn't it? Never mind that the Kansas tornado you're thinking about never happened. Are there more words with the letter R in the first position or the third position? Most people say it's the first position. It's easier to come up with words beginning with R than words having an R in the third position, because we file words in our minds by their initial letters, and so they're more available as we rummage through memory. But in fact, there are more words with R in the third position. One problem with using the availability heuristic for judgments of frequency or plausibility is that availability is tangled up with salience. Deaths by earthquake are easier to recall than deaths by asthma, so people overestimate the frequency of earthquake deaths in their country by a lot and underestimate the frequency of asthma deaths hugely. Heuristics, including the representativeness heuristic and the availability heuristic, operate quite automatically and often unconsciously. This means it's going to be hard to know just how influential they can be. But knowing about them allows us to reflect on the possibility that we've been led astray by them in a particular instance. Summing up, it's possible to make fewer errors in judgment by following a few simple suggestions implicit in this chapter. Remember that all perceptions, judgments, and beliefs are inferences and not direct readouts of reality. This recognition should prompt an appropriate humility about just how certain we should be about our judgments, as well as a recognition that the views of other people that differ from our own may have more validity than our intuitions tell us they do. Be aware that our schemas affect our construals. Schemas and stereotypes guide our understanding of the world, but they can lead to pitfalls that can be avoided by recognizing the possibility that we may be relying too heavily on them. We can try to recognize our own stereotype-driven judgments as well as recognize those of others. Remember that incidental, irrelevant perceptions and cognitions can affect our judgment and behavior. Even when we don't know what those factors might be, we need to be aware that much more is influencing our thinking and behavior than we can be aware of. An important implication is that it will increase accuracy to try to encounter objects and people in as many different circumstances as possible if a judgment about them is important. Be alert to the possible role of heuristics in producing judgments. Remember that the similarity of objects and events to one another can be a misleading basis for judgments. Remember that causes need not resemble effects in any way. And remember that assessments of the likelihood or frequency of events can be influenced simply by the readiness with which they come to mind. Many of the concepts and principles you're going to hear about in this book are helpful in avoiding the kinds of inferential errors discussed in this chapter. These new concepts and principles will supplement and sometimes actually replace those you normally use. Chapter 2. The Power of the Situation. The previous chapter showed that we're frequently ignorant about the influence of irrelevant, incidental, and scarcely noticed stimuli in producing our judgments and behavior. Unfortunately, we're also frequently blind to the role played by factors that are not incidental or evanescent at all, but rather are the prime movers affecting our judgments and behavior. In particular, we often underestimate or fail to notice at all some of the most important situational influences that markedly affect beliefs and behavior. A direct consequence of this context blindness is that we tend to exaggerate the influence of personal dispositional factors, preferences, personality traits, abilities, plans, and motives on behavior in a given situation. Both the slighting of the situation and the exaggeration of internal factors occur even when we're trying to analyze the reasons for our own judgments and the causes of our own behavior. But the problem is much greater when it's the causes of other people's behavior we're trying to figure out. I have to attend to many aspects of the context and situation if I'm going to be able to form a judgment or carry out some behavior. But the situation confronting another person may be difficult or impossible for me to see. So I'm particularly likely to underestimate the importance of the situation for another's behavior and to overestimate internal factors. The failure to recognize the importance of contexts and situations and the consequent overestimation of the role of personal dispositions is, I believe, the most pervasive and consequential inferential mistake we make. The social psychologist Lee Ross has labeled this the fundamental attribution error.